Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwendinger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a lovely five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some cybersecurity recent news and headlines that hopefully provide some insight and analysis, practical application you can take back to the office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
Yeah, Matt, did you know it turns out that some computers are taken advantage of faster and with more frequency than prom dates?
That doesn't surprise me.
I didn't think it would, considering how your prom went.
Yeah, nobody got lucky.
So the first article we're going to talk about is these researchers wanted to test cloud security. They were shocked by what they found.
That is such a classic headline, such a classic internet headline.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's perfect clickbait headline. Usually you see them in those little tiny picture boxes at the bottom, which has a picture, some chick in a bikini at the bottom of the news article.
What were they testing? Were they testing Pornhub?
Anyway, so this comes to us from GDNet. And then, so what happened was some researchers were setting up some honeypots to see how cyber attackers or how attackers work and get some, and they ended up with some interesting statistics based on these honeypots that they deployed. So Palo Alto set up 320 honeypots throughout the entire world, some probably in AWS, I believe. But they set up these 320 honeypots, and they had them misconfigured in a couple of standard ways. So they had weak passwords on RDP, SSH. They had SMB open to the internet, and they had some Postgres databases. So what they found was that 80% of the 320 were compromised within 24 hours. And all 320 were compromised within a week.
I mean, that's not really a surprise to me. That people have been talking about that for years, right? Putting a unpatched system, you know, on without a firewall, and you're going to get popped. That being said, it's nice to have some confirmation so you can point to when someone asks you why we're not doing that.
Right. And so, and for the RDP and SSH, it was mostly default or weak passwords versus actually vulnerabilities in those protocols. And SSH was the most attacked application, which was seen in this 320 or this group of 320 honeypots. So they had each, and this is for every instance of an SSH honeypot out of 320. They didn't actually give the number, but each SSH honeypot was compromised on average. So some more, some less, 26 times a day. So at least once, more than once an hour, the SSH boxes were getting cracked.
You know, that actually has been something that's really interested me is, you know, when these new vulnerabilities come out or things like that happen, everybody talks about like the big group that compromises them or whatever, but there's very little talk about, you know, multiple compromises and people compromising on top of compromising.
Yeah, it used to be much more talked about back in the early days of, I don't know exactly what you want to call it, but, you know, really when cyber started getting big in the late 90s, early 2000s, where, you know, based on my own experience, seeing attackers compromise boxes and then patch them to ensure that someone else didn't come in behind them and compromise that same box.
Yeah.
Don't hear about that a lot now, which I'm kind of surprised that if that is still not going on, because once you get that foothold, that's your resource at that point. You know, you compromise it, you put in the effort, that's your box, you own it, you know, as the saying goes. You're not going to want someone else to come in and take over that box, especially if you're using it for resources like crypto mining or something like that.
Yeah, someone else compromises and puts their crypto mine on it too. That's half your profits.
Yeah, well, I mean, someone comes in and ransomware is your ransomware.
Or ransomware's your crypto mining. You're like, no, I'll pay for it. Just leave the crypto miners alone.
Yeah, so they actually, all this happens on the dark net. The company doesn't even know they got compromised. And the most attacked honeypot out of this 320 was compromised 169 times in a single day.
That's ridiculous.
And they also saw that 96, that one attacker compromised 96% of the 80 Postgres honeypots. So out of that 320, 80 of those were Postgres databases. One attacker compromised 96% of those 80 databases in 90 seconds.
That one actually kind of surprises me, mostly because of how quick it was. I assume since these are scattered globally, they were also scattered via IP as well. So that does suggest to me that they did the compromise, or they did the recon first and then swept out and compromised all at once. But that's just interesting. I would have expected them to, you know, be compromised kind of sequentially or as the script went through or whatever.
Well, what could have happened is that the guy is, like you said, he's doing recon, which is then assembling his database. So maybe he runs that for 24 hours. Yeah. And then he takes that list and spits that into his attack platform, and that just executes. So that's most likely how it happened versus, you know, what a lot of people are thinking of when they hear this is probably recon attack versus, you know, a mass recon and then one attack phase.
That's fair. That's funny.
So I think, you know, we've talked about the speed with stuff gets attacked before. I think this really highlights that, you know, don't think that you can put anything on the internet that is not hardened right from the jump and think you're going to fix it after it's already there. There's just no time. You're not going to get it fixed fast enough to do that. So, and this is something I've seen before is where, you know, people will build a system and they will not put a serious password on it because they're still tweaking it and they don't want to have to remember a hard password when they're going in and logging in this for the days or weeks that they're using it in order to actually develop it or build it or what have you. So, if that's the way that things operate, you definitely want to ensure you go through a hardening process that goes through and cleans that stuff up or those type of things up before you move it into production, especially if it's internet facing.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this highlights, you know, patching internet facing systems should be at the top of your list.
Yeah. I mean, so speaking on that, actually, is it worth, you know, never mind, the business would never let you do it. I was thinking about dynamically and automatically pulling systems off the internet if they had like a critical patch or something, like moving them between VLANs. But no, the business would have a fit if you pulled one of their business critical systems off the internet.
Well, I would say they'd probably be all for it, provided that it wasn't customer impacting. You know, because if you had, let's say you had a box in the back, you know, and this is in the virtual sense, and a box out front, you patch the box in the back and then you swap them dynamically and then patch the other box and then swap them back or something like that. They'd probably be fine with that kind of concept.
Yeah.
You know, dynamic, kind of like a dynamic scaling model, except for those systems that are not down before they're brought up are brought current first.
Yeah.
Because imagine you could do that. I mean, you could probably do that in an automated fashion without too much trouble with a load balancer out front that, you know, has a pool of systems behind it. And you just put up a box that's fully patched into the rotation. And then you take one of the other boxes out of the rotation, patch it, put it back in and do it like that. So that your customers don't even realize that you're in the process of patching your front end, because they're at any point in time, they are connected to a different system on the pool. Because what you do is when you take it out of the rotation, you wait for the customers just to fall off as a natural progression. You know, you don't boot them, but when they leave that server, no new customers come onto that server. And then when that's empty, you take it out, fix it, and then put it back up. And you do that all through the entire pool of front-end systems behind that load balancer.
All right. For the second article, I had one that I found super interesting, although I will admit up front, I don't know much about DAOs. So we're going to talk about it, but who knows if we're going to come to any conclusions. And it is BadgerDAO DeFi defunded as hackers apparently nab millions in crypto tokens. And it's from the Register, which is weird because this is a fairly calm headline for the Register. So we'll start off with kind of some definitions, since this is from the crypto world more than the security world. But that's part of the reason I wanted to highlight this, is these things are going to start overlapping more and more in the future. And I personally don't have a ton of experience in crypto, and I imagine there's a lot of security people out there who don't themselves. So a DAO is a DAO, Decentralized Autonomous Organization. The Wikipedia definition is it is an organization represented by rules encased as a transparent computer program, controlled by the organization members and not influenced by a central government.
Oh, this is kind of like that smart contracts concept, right?
Yes. Yes, it is a smart contracts concept. It's the organization's rules are computer code. No bureaucracy is needed to run. There's no CEO. There's no middle management. There are no directors. People can own management tokens that allow them to vote on the direction of the DAO. So I was listening to another podcast on, there was technically a finance podcast where they were talking about Constitution DAO, how you can, if you have the management tokens, theoretically you can buy them all if you can, and then you'll control the whole organization. But of course it's difficult because everybody has it. It's very much analogous to stocks. So BadgerDAO makes a product called SET, which allows users to deposit crypto assets and loan them out to earn interest or yield. It's a quote from the article. And it looks like this is kind of an individual way to do it. Voyager, Gemini, BlockFi are doing right now. All of them offer products where you can deposit your crypto with them and then you'll earn interest because they're loaning it out to other people and giving you, you know, 70% of the interest and keeping the rest for themselves. Although the big difference is most of those guys are offering, you know, 8 to 10% annual percentage yield interest rates. BadgerDAO was saying you can make 23 to 75% APY, which is crazy. Wow.
That's ridiculous.
Even though this happened, I'm still thinking like, wow, that's a lot. Maybe I should put a little in here. Yeah, it's a lot of interest.
I was just saying, don't gamble with what you can't afford to lose.
Yeah, yeah. They did see a post from an individual they thought was a developer for BadgerDAO based on the Twitter handle. The Twitter handle was the same last name as one of the developers, which I find really interesting because, again, in this decentralized organization, you don't necessarily know. There's no employees. You don't necessarily know who's making the comments you're reading. But anyways, they said that a hacker was able to inject a script into the website. And then when people went in to access their wallets, therefore the hacker got access to the wallet and then would siphon off the coins. And they even said the script would start and stop at random intervals. So not everybody got their wallets drained. And the total losses were estimated at $120 million.
Wow. That's a heck of a payday.
Yeah. And that's part of the interesting thing to me about crypto and why I think that crypto is going to be, all these crypto companies that are getting, you know, trillions of dollars in assets have got to be just have enormous targets on their back, because if you get the coins out, they can't get the coins back. Now, that being said, you know, most crypto is not nearly as anonymous as people thought it was originally. So you can track where the coins go, but you know, you can't get it. It's almost like in some ways the money is almost frozen unless you can find some way to put it through one of the tumblers or whatever they call it, where they exchange your dirty crypto for clean.
Yeah. And eventually you have to end up with the wrench to get it back out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's the same problem that they have with cash, where, you know, if you steal the money, how do you get the money out? Well, you have to go to another country, or you have to, you know, get people to be, to, you know, go and use the ATMs, what do they call them?
Mules.
There we go. Yeah. You've got to get the money out somehow. So, but I'm sure they'll figure it out. They always have. So the company brought in Mandiant and Chainalysis. Chainalysis is a blockchain-specific forensic company, probably figuring out where all those Bitcoin went and all the Ethereum went. The article had another example about MonoX, which is another crypto company. They lost $31 million this year because their smart contract had a little bug in it where it didn't check to make sure the token being bought and sold were different. So somebody figured that out and they bought and sold the same token many, many, many times, which drove the price up of the tokens because it looked like it was in demand and lots of people were buying it. And then they exchanged their tokens for real, more valuable assets like Ethereum and Bitcoin, and then walked away with the Ethereum and Bitcoin.
Wow.
Yeah, this is, there's so much money going into this, and it's just such an immature, I mean, it's cool. Don't get me wrong. DAOs are cool. I love the idea that, you know, there's all kinds of cool things they're talking about, like maybe building, making a DAO that will own houses, like real estate. So you can own part of a real estate empire or something. And then they hire, you know, a management company to run it. Like, and maybe an investment firm where the specific investment types are all coded in the DAO. You know, it'll buy these things, it'll buy these things now, it'll do this, and you buy a coin, and that coin represents, you know, all the coins together represent the value of all the investments. Like, there's so many cool use cases for this. Constitution DAO, which I'm sure was a big in the news. They were going to buy the Constitution, then they were going to loan it to a museum. There's just so many cool use cases, but that it frightens me as a security professional.
Well, you know what the market needs? This needs another group of companies. This has probably been said to death, but like an underwriter's laboratory that's going to certify the DAO.
Yeah, the code is mostly bug free. And
right. So that people can have confidence that the DAO is going to work. Because it is immature, people are just guessing right now. There's nobody that's standing behind it saying, yeah, here's the reason that you should trust it. And when stuff like this happens, then that starts to erode the trust. So some other organization or organizations need to stand up that are going to build the credibility behind this to say, here's what we do, and here's how we've certified that this is safe, or this is, you know, this is a good thing to invest in, or whatever. Because right now, and the news doesn't help this at all, because anytime anything like this happens, the news articles always continue to sow the doubt that this is even a good idea at all.
Yeah.
Versus saying that, yeah, this is a mistake that was made early on, but we're going to mature, and this is going to get better, and this is going to get safer, and more people are going to benefit from this in the future. They're trying to scare people away from it altogether.
Yeah, this is the gold rush in California in 1849 or whatever, where everybody's running, everybody's trying to guess right, everybody's trying to pick up the land, or, you know, build the DAO that's going to be the next Ethereum or Bitcoin.
Right. So what I'm saying right now is we need those
build the stores.
Those merchants.
Yeah, yeah.
That supported that to happen.
You heard it here first, guys. We're starting a blockchain security company focused on securing DAOs. I mean, you laugh, but that's a great idea. If I knew anything about DAOs or blockchain.
Yeah. I mean, you and I were both, you know, well, experienced programmers too.
Yeah.
We could probably get in on this.
Yeah, I can imagine. I could see that the future of security for these DAOs is probably some method of like building a waiting period almost into there. Like, cause right now, well, I know it's not instantaneous because you have to wait for the transaction to be registered on the blockchain before it's official. But I could see, like, you know, double checks and waiting periods and validation checks and all that stuff just hasn't happened yet. We're just playing fast and loose right now. Fast and loose.
Right. It's like the only step is the transaction versus having like, a man trap.
Between
the transaction and the output.
Well, you know what's funny actually is I'm thinking like that delay thing. That's exactly what you have right now with wire transfer for a bank, right? You've got like a 24-hour period or something where you can claw it back pretty easily. But then now we're just turning it into banking. Although I guess it's banking that the banks don't control, so that would still be a plus.
Right.
I don't know. All right. But anyways, I had a couple questions on this. So if there's no, and Eddie, and I know we talked about this before, David, you may not know how to answer it. I don't think I know how to answer it, but I'm curious about, like, if there's no centralized management, how does a DAO respond quickly and effectively to a security incident? Do you have to gather everybody together and everybody's got to vote with their token to say, you know, yes, we declare a security incident? I mean, I imagine you can delegate responsibility to a specific person maybe, but then now aren't you kind of, getting away from the decentralized and employee-less model?
Well, I don't know how this works with the overall management of the company in in light of at least US government regulations, for, you know, there must, the CEO must sign off on financial statements and stuff like that. So I'm not sure, because it doesn't say that this was an LLC or something, but I assume it's got to be incorporated in some way if it's a business. I mean, of course, I am thinking about this in the US centric. I'm not sure if this is a US company or not, or organization. But I think there are other things around here that are going to be difficult or hard to organize to meet US regulations around financial requirements and things like that for companies and responsibility.
So next question, who monitors for incidents if there's no employees in the traditional sense? I assume, you know, one of the developers that's working on it would get it. And frankly, even, I'm not even sure, I assume people get paid in tokens for the work they do on a DAO. Like if someone is developing code for the DAO, I assume they get tokens as payment, which I guess you could then do for anybody. You know, maybe you have a security analyst who's getting tokens, but then how do you avoid people taking advantage of it just to get free tokens and not doing the work? I mean, there's all kinds of things that managers exist for, and most of them are crap, I will admit it, but sometimes managers are occasionally useful.
Well, the simple answer to that is they have a smart contract with an MSSP that does the security monitoring.
MSSPs are terrible though.
Well, yeah, it's a trade-off, maybe.
All right. And this is then, frankly, I don't, like I said, I don't know the answer to these questions, but if DAOs are going to have a big future, someone's going to have to figure out the answers to these, or else every time one of these DAOs gets hacked and they lose all their money, they're not going to last.
Yeah. Well, that could be part of this other company that I was talking about as well, that underwrites, not exactly underwrites, but has some kind of certification for these companies, not only to say that we've looked at the technology behind it and it's sound, but also the structure of the organization is sound. How they've structured their DAO and how, you know, they pay people and how it transacts and things of that nature. So, you know, you could have maybe even that's two companies, one that certifies the technical part and one that certifies the operational part.
Yeah,
because I really like this this concept. Surprisingly enough, because I'm not much for, you know, command and control.
And I guess you could have an MSSP that specializes in blockchain related security. Because when you were talking about it before, I was thinking more of the traditional MSSP. And again, you've got the same problem. Like, who do you send the alerts to? Do you send the alerts to everybody with a management token? And I don't know.
Well, I mean, if you did that, then then they can deny responsibility. Well, I thought Bob was going to do it.
Yeah. But on the other hand, though, I could actually see, unrelated, but I've never been a software engineer, but somebody in Reddit was commenting about how software engineers, there's a big kind of moonlighting tradition there, where software engineers, you know, work after hours on other projects, and then, you know, a lot of them have their own GitHub and stuff. And for security, there's a lot less of that sort of thing. There's very few kind of like contract jobs you can do a couple hours a week. This actually, something like this would be kind of an interesting way, where you come in and you review a security incident for somebody and you get paid with a token. And, you know, maybe it only happens once every couple of weeks, but you sign up to a couple of these guys and you be an interesting kind of contractor line of work.
Yeah, this is actually something I've thought about before, but I haven't really concentrated on it to figure out how it would work in implementation. Because I was thinking about an MSSP that was purely cloud-based, that didn't necessarily have employees or analysts on the payroll, but worked more like a volunteer kind of basis or something like that to come in and work the console. Like I said, I haven't thought through it a lot, but it's something I've kind of been rolling around in the back of my mind about how that kind of thing would work.
Yeah.
Where either you would be able to contract an individual analyst to work for X period, or where, you know, kind of like an Uber almost. Hey, I'm a security analyst. I've got 5 hours to kill right now. I'll log in and say, hey, I'm up to take a monitoring gig somewhere.
You know, like Mechanical Turk.
I'm not familiar with that.
Mechanical Turk is an Amazon thing where you can put little tasks. Like, let's say you have some silly repetitive task you need done 1,000 times. You can put it up on Mechanical Turk and people can claim it and do it for a while.
Yeah, kind of like that.
Yeah.
Say, hey, I'm a security analyst. I have 5 hours to kill. You log in and say, all right, you're going to work. And they just kind of allocate you to this company on the fly. Not necessarily the same one you worked on last week or before or whatever. But we need a security analyst over here for 5 hours. So you put it up there. Or maybe you kind of post, hey, we need a security analyst for 5 hours and we're bidding $15 an hour. Mm-hmm. Someone willing to do this for $15 an hour.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually would be really interested in that. And then you could also kind of crowdsource and have the reviews, you know. You work for this company for 4 or 5 hours, and then later they find out you screwed up and they're like 1 star, and versus, you know, oh, they, you know, did everything well. They gave us really good instructions on how to do it. Of course, I don't think I'd work for $15 an hour for that, but.
Right. Well, I mean, that was just a throwaway number, because that would be depending on what security analysts are available to bid up that number, you know, because if nobody takes it at 15 for 10 minutes, maybe it goes up to 20 or it goes up to 16. You know, and every minute or 5 minutes or something, it increments up until someone says, I'll take it at that price point.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be interesting too. Yeah. And you probably wouldn't want to do individual alerts that way, but like I could see like a malware response or something, like take a look at this malware response. Did anything, you know, was there an active attacker? Do we need to do anything special with it? Or can we just wipe the box and move on, especially for small and medium-sized businesses that don't have that.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of different ways you could do it. I think you could bid out shifts. You could bid out events. You could bid out forensic work, maybe, or, you know, malware analysis or something like that, or review a sandbox report. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there are, and you could do all, I think that, you know, you could structure an MSP to kind of encompass virtually all of those kind of different aspects as well. So you'd have two different sides of that. You know, you have the analysts that, you know, bid on whichever those things are, those actions or shifts or however you have it. And then you have companies on the other side, and this is the harder part, that are going to have to subscribe to that MSSP, because, you know, you and I both know the challenges of onboarding a company to an MSSP. You'd have to have some way to make that an easy bolt-on or an easy thing for the MSSP to do, to onboard a company to get that value for them.
Yep. Because you know the logs and you know the other information, and you can't, now if you can't feed it in all the time to the MSSP, you need some way to package it up and send the correct logs.
Right.
To the analyst. Yeah. All right. Anyways, we got off on a tangent and I don't want to let that run forever.
All right. Well, let's just jump on to the next article, which should be, it's a fairly short discussion for this one. So hackers increasingly use RTF template injection technique in phishing attacks. And RTF is rich text format. And this is kind of like text plus. And this comes to us from Hacker News. And so what's happening here is attackers are using email attachments in rich text format using a RTF template injection technique, that once that file is open, it automatically goes out and retrieves malware from the internet using a URL which is embedded within the file.
Yeah, this was kind of a surprise to me. I've never seen RTF files doing this sort of thing. Like, you expect this kind of nonsense from Microsoft files.
Right. Well, this is typically opened by a Word document, but there are other applications that will open RTF files. I think this is the key part of this is that most people are not doing anything about RTF files. They are not considering them potential sources of maliciousness, number one. So they're not blocking them. And number two, no one thinks that, you know, there are no macros or anything like that in there. So they don't expect them to be able to do any real actions when you open them. So what the attackers do is they take that RTF template format and they alter the document's properties using the hex editor to specify a URL resource instead of an accessible file resource destination where they can retrieve that malicious payload from. So all someone has to do is open that file, and that template thinks it needs to retrieve a resource from somewhere, which is typically local, but instead of retrieving it from local, they retrieve it from the internet.
Yeah, and I'll admit, typically when I see RTF files, I don't immediately think there's something malicious here. That's not a file format that I have mentally associated with, you know, bad stuff.
Now, like I was saying earlier, I kind of think of RTF as, you know, plain text plus, you know, versus Word document or something like that. So you don't anticipate that there's anything malicious about it. And the part of this, what makes this also interesting about this is that it's going to execute that background code to retrieve that resource before it displays anything in the file. So if you open one of these, by the time you see the contents of the file, the malware is already on the machine.
Nice.
And according to the article, they think it's currently is limited to just a handful of APT actors with a certain range of sophistication for using this. But they expect this to really take off because it's not that difficult to do. So I think this is something that's probably going to be an increasing thorn in our side in the future. The one thing here that is going to help you out, of course, is if you have a well-configured proxy, that's going to prevent it from retrieving that URL, depending on, you know, how your proxy settings are configured. And one thing I was thinking about with this as well, and I do not have the answer here, but I'm wondering if you could format an email to be a rich text template and do this just with a plain email or the regular email. Because you can send plain text emails, you can send RTF emails, and you can send HTML emails. So a lot of people have been very leery of the HTML emails for obvious reasons, but not many people are too concerned about RTF. So I'm wondering if you could do this with an RTF formatted email as well.
That's a good question.
So yeah, bottom line here is this is something we're going to see increasing use of. I'm not sure if it's going to make any sense for you to block RTF at your mail client or your mail gateway. Probably would not hurt to survey your inbound traffic now to see what kind of attachments you're seeing, to see what the volume of RTF attachments is. Because if it's low, maybe you do go ahead and block that now. Because while I am kind of used to using RTF because it has advantages of text without the bulk of Word documents, I'm not sure a lot of people do use this very heavily. So just take a look at that. And again, make sure your proxy's configured as tightly as you can have it to block those kind of URL grabs.
That makes sense. Yeah, it seems like this is more of an awareness thing. Again, don't ignore them. Don't just ignore them because you think they're cool. All right. Article number four is from me. This one's a pretty simple one too. Google's cybersecurity action team released a threat horizons report focused on cloud security, and Malwarebytes is talking crap about it.
No, no one can talk crap about Google.
Yeah. Apparently people are unhappy that it's a straightforward and fairly simple report.
What?
I'm shocked. But some of the findings were kind of interesting. Before we talk about the straightforward part, 86% of compromised Google Cloud Platform instances were used to perform crypto mining. Surprise.
Wow.
I know, shocking. 10% conducted scans of other infrastructure, and 8% were used to attack other targets. One group of attackers they specifically called out used it to get YouTube views. I assume for the ad revenue, although maybe the crime lord's daughter really needed her channel to get up to 1 million views or something. I don't know.
So I guess this presumes that 2% of that scanning infrastructure was failing to find targets.
Yeah, I don't know where the overlap there is. It's got to be, but if only 86%, well, they didn't, maybe there's some smaller percentages they didn't list, but yeah, if you assume that those two are a Venn diagram that completely overlaps, it leaves 4% blank. So I was assuming that, you know, there was some overlap there, but not 100%.
No, I'm just
guessing. Yeah. it could be either way. They made a couple of recommendations. They recommend you audit published products to ensure certs and crets are not accidentally exposed. Wow, that's excellent advice. They recommended code downloaded by client should undergo hashed authentication to avoid man-in-the-middle attacks. Mm. I am not 100% sure how man-in-the-middle attacks comes in for these Google Cloud Platform things. Are they saying that the hacked Google platform is man-in-the-middling between your internal servers and the client?
I'm not sure. I've never used Google Cloud, so I'm not sure exactly how it works. I would think
I'm once assuming it works like Amazon.
It would come across an encrypted channel.
Yeah. So that recommendation just does not make sense to me compared to the findings. Like, there's nothing in the findings about Google Cloud Platform being used for man in the middle or to download, you know, malicious code that's pretending to be real code. So anyways, that one recommendation just was kind of out of left field. I mean, sure, it's a good recommendation. We should do it. But what does it have to do with everything else? And then the third recommendation was use multiple layers of defense to combat credential and cookie theft. Sure, definitely a good idea. So, discussion points. Why are people so unhappy that it is simplistic and straightforward? Most companies can't get the basics correct anyways, so telling them something fun and advanced and complicated is probably not much help anyways.
Well, maybe they're just saying, well, you're just telling us shit we were already told. like the second time the pen test company came back.
Oh, yeah. Like, hey, and found the exact same thing is wrong. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is very much how I feel about Threat Intel, because Threat Intel is fancy and it's all talking about like, we need to do more advanced stuff and we need to create, you know, custom protections for these APTs that are targeting us. No, they're the APTs that are targeting you. You're using the same things the regular criminals are doing to target you, you know, phishing emails, open RDP, breaking in via your exposed web servers, like patch your stuff.
Passwords.
Password
reuse.
Yep. Rotate your passwords, complex passwords, patch your stuff, you know, put a phishing tool in, phishing training. It's the same protections for the criminals and the APT people. The APT people don't have to get too fancy because most of the time they just get in with the same stuff. Sure, every now and then they have to get really fancy and crazy. And, you know, and if you're Capital One, you know, you don't have to listen to my advice. You got your own thing going on. But yeah, for 90% of the businesses,
they're using the same tier attack structure that, you know, other high level organizations are using. You know, start with the least invasive and then work your way up to the top. And if your target is more valuable than your exploit, go ahead and use your exploit. But if it's not, don't use your exploit. And they're just going to go up as high as they need to in order to get to what they want.
Yep. Yep. I was kind of surprised at how prevalent crypto mining is. I mean, I'm not surprised how prevalent crypto mining is. I'm surprised how prevalent it is compared to other things. The Verizon DBR this year, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. One of their top ones was malware distribution. I mean, they do say that 8% were used to attack other targets. I suppose they could be including malware in that, but that seems a lot. I feel like it didn't Verizon have like 30% of targeted systems were used to distribute malware or something like that. I thought it was ridiculously high.
I do not remember.
That's fair. Same with command and control. Although again, maybe command and control is incorporated into that 8% used to attack other targets. Cause that's, we talked about it the other week when we talked about hacking back, like kind of the common sense general rule of thumb is that when attackers hit you, they're not hitting you through their own infrastructure. They're hitting you through compromised infrastructure, and maybe that's not quite as prevalent as we thought, given that only 8% of these targets were used to attack other targets. I guess you'd have to do the survey from the other side, look at a company and look how often they're attacked, and then kind of track back those IPs and figure out who owned those IPs.
Yeah, well, it could just be a matter of market share. Google is not the leader here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. So anyways, I my personal thoughts on this is I'm not unhappy. I appreciate that they released a more straightforward report. Looking over the DBR for the last several years, it's apparent we're still not doing the basics right. And I don't think we need to be doing fancy stuff before we can. I don't think we should be running before we walk. And a lot of companies are really struggling in terms of walking.
Yeah, I think, you know, it'd be something valuable for the cloud companies to put their heads together and come up with like an OWASP top 10 for these are the most misconfigured items in cloud installations or cloud usage or something like that. Just to do what they can to get those basics knocked out. And maybe even rather than even coming up with that list, if they come up with the list, just make sure that those items are configured in a default secure manner in their cloud instances. And you have to willingly go in and misconfigure them or change the configuration in order to put them into the secure way.
Well, that looks like that's all the articles we have today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.